Forrest McDonald continues, in regards to his being trusted, it is easy to overlook a crucial ingredient that Americans sorely needed someone to trust. I'd say that's true today, wouldn't you? Partly this need rose from the perilousness of the undertaking on which they embarked in 1776. They had no way of knowing whether they would be founders or failures. The winners in such circumstances are called patriots. The losers are called traitors. But there is more to the point than that. Difficult as it may be to imagine, Americans were a monarchical people. A people who loved their kings. George III had been especially beloved, and when he betrayed Americans by making war on them, they reacted by embracing republicanism and by refusing to entrust executive power to anyone. And yet, by embracing republicanism and by refusing to entrust executive power to anyone, and yet the craving for a symbol to embody the nation remained. In this diverse new entity, the United States of America, it was not enough to have leaders, no matter how virtuous or capable. There had to be one above all others. As Americans had earlier referred to George III as the father of his people, they now needed someone to call the father of his country. If there were to be a country and not 13 separate countries. Washington satisfied this need. His physical appearance was complemented by an aura not merely of strength, but of invincibility. His immunity to gunfire seemed almost supernatural. You know, there's so many stories of him standing there or sitting there on his horse, too close to the battlefield, and he's got Nathaniel Greene or Henry Knox going, "Hey, man, dude, you need to get to the back of the line, bro. You're going to get shot." And Washington saying, I lead my men and I lead them up here. I forget how many bullet holes, at least two that I know of, one at Monmouth and another in a battle, that a bullet just passed right through his coat. It didn't hit him, but it hit his big coat, flew out the back. But if it was his natural gifts that made others prove to trust him, then there remains the question, how did he come to be worthy of trust? The answer is he made himself that way. To understand how he did it, we must turn to the prevailing ideas about nature, about the nature of the human animal. Firstly, every American at that time believed in God, the God of both the Old Testament and the New, which meant that while they believed in the possibility of redemption in the hereafter, they also believed in original sin and the inherent baseness of man. And yet, though man could not escape his nature, there were a number of ways he could improve himself. And again, this is all about George Washington, the indispensable American, here on his actual birthday. A perceptive person could turn this instinct into an engine for self-improvement, which is what George Washington did. As a child, he devoutly wished to become a country gentleman, and toward that end, he recorded and followed 110 rules of civility and decent behavior in company and conversation. That book is still out there. As a matter of fact, I have a copy of it somewhere. I don't have it here, but I do have a copy of it. Notice the adolescent Washington's phraseology, those of higher quality than yourself. 18th century Virginia society was highly stratified. Then he goes into more of what made George Washington the man that he was. Washington made that a guiding star for his own conduct. Later, when circumstances and his achievements made it possible, he aimed his sights even higher. And he sought by conscious design to earn the esteem of posterity, of generations of discerning and virtuous people yet unborn. Did you know that before he died that he went through all his correspondence and he burned about 2/3 of it? Now, somebody may be going, "Miniature plane, why do I need to know stupid thing like that? What does that matter?" The one third that survives fills up like 8 volumes. That's quite a correspondence. Washington was also one of these guys that was a hands-on dude. So he spent a couple of hours a day with a scribe. What's a scribe? Scribe is someone that was basically, you'd call it a secretary today, would take dictation. He'd read the letter and he'd go like, all right, let me write a response. But he wouldn't actually write it. He'd dictate it. You can tell the difference in the letters that are written. And if you look at Washington's letters and then you look at what's written in his diaries. Because his penmanship is good, but the guy that was the scribe has far better penmanship than Washington does in his diaries. And then Forrest McDonald tells the story. The key to Washington's success as a farmer. Now, note that Washington was also a farmer, like Dan Mundy, the old farmer. And ultimately, he would become the old farmer. What do we spend a lot of time talking about? The church and the farm. Distributism for Dorothy, which, by the way, is sitting there collecting dust on the farm books shelf in the Founders Trading Post. He conducted endless experiments and made endless calculations. And if McDonald said my favorite part is that he determined that there were 13,411,000 grains in a bushel of timothy. He invented a plow that automatically dropped seeds in the furrows. He was his own architect in the construction of Mount Vernon. You know, remember I was asking a question about the Walls and West Place project the other day, our new studio in Homestead, and how it was that we're going to build it without usury and without banks, because someone has to do this to show that it can be done and then pave the way for the rest of you to also try and do it. He drew the plans for Mount Vernon. He didn't pay an architect. He probably went and studied a little engineering enough to know, or Roman engineering, enough to know about archways and weight transfers and what do you engineers, what do you architects call it? One force is thrust and the other on a roof line, for example. One is thrust, I think that's what goes outward, and the other is shear, right? Thrust and shear. If you know a little bit about thrust and shear and can do simple trigonometry, you can be an architect. I can be an architect. As a matter of fact, I am. Washington's opportunity would come to lead 20 years later when the Continental Congress convened to defend American liberties against British encroachments. Washington was the obvious choice for commander-in-chief, partly because he was the only American with an intercolonial reputation as a fighting man, partly because as a Virginian in charge of New England troops, he would give the army a national flavor. However, lest Congress overlook the obvious, he showed up at Congress every day dressed in a general's uniform. So when it came time to do this, Washington was like, hey, I'm sitting over here. I can be, and people go like, he was the only one that could have done it. Not according, no, it's not. There were 3 guys that were gunning for him. Read Life of Washington. You'll learn this. One of them was Lincoln. The other was, I'm trying to think of the other, Lee. And the other was, who's the one that the Brits captured in his pajamas? They all thought that they could be CIC, that's Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army. War would have ended in disaster if that would have happened. By the way, it's another reason why George Washington, indispensable man. When you look at everyone knows about Christmas Day, 1776, crossing the Delaware. Everybody knows about it. What you don't know, and you need the whole story, I have a drama about it. It's called Times That Try Men's Souls. Washington had to cross 6 other rivers to get to the south side of the Delaware. And he wasn't just crossing them like Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn. He was being chased by men with guns who were shooting at him. He had to cross the East River onto Manhattan. From Manhattan, they had to cross the Harlem River. From the Harlem River, they had to get across the Hudson. Once they were on the upstate side of Manhattan, on the land side, not on off the island, then they had to cross the Hudson. Then he had to cross the Hackensack. Then he had to cross the Passaic. Then he had to cross the Raritan. I might have that out of order. And after all that, that's six. Then he had to cross the Delaware. That's seven. How the hell do you cross 6,000 men, cannons, and horses? Horses? We don't need no horses. How do you do all that? You got some serious leadership skills, and you got some serious ferry builders and your army. And then, it was Gates. I said Lee and Lincoln. It was Gates. In the fall of 1777, General Horatio Gates won a major victory in upstate New York, but out of jealousy of Washington, he declined to cooperate with the main army. And as a result, the enemy took Philadelphia. Why? Because Gates camped out in Saratoga. Washington kept writing him a letter going, dude, what are you doing? You're needed here. You got 10,000 troops. Get your butt down here. He never did. Somehow, by one means or another, Washington kept the army together, which is why Times of Try Men's Souls is just, it's a great story. Me and my daughter, Madison, I tell it to her. She was a teenager then, and it's a great little dialogue, but it tells this story that no one knows. They made a couple of movies. Jeff Daniels was in a movie called The Crossing. It's pretty good. And that's a pretty accurate portrayal of Washington's crossing the seven, some of the seven rivers. Even so, danger persisted. This is after Trenton. A peace treaty had to be negotiated, and the army was held in Newburgh, New York, in readiness to fight against if the negotiations failed. The soldiers were restless. This is after Cornwallis had surrendered to him at Yorktown. And by the by, Cornwallis was so embarrassed that Washington had beaten him and had tricked him and cornered him at Yorktown. He didn't show up. He was like Justin Trudeau. He didn't show up at the surrender ceremony. He sent a lieutenant to go present his sword, coward. Grumbling increased alarmingly and reached a climax in 1783 when anonymous pamphlets were circulated among the officers calling for a meeting where plans were to be made to seek justice. They were going to go to Congress, and they're going to say, look, you yahoos, you got to pay us. And they were basically going to have a coup. To the surprise of the mutinous officers, George Washington showed up at the meeting. He was, and by the way, he was not invited. They knew they couldn't invite Washington because he wouldn't go along with it. He had written a short speech, and when he took it from his coat, and this is another famous story that most people don't know. He had written a short speech, and when he took it from his coat pocket, he also drew out a pair of eyeglasses, which only his aides and closest friends knew that he needed. He began, quote, gentlemen, you will permit me to put on my spectacles, for I have not only grown gray, but also blind in the service of my country, close quote. 60 seconds later, one of the eyewitnesses who was there said there was not a dry eye in the room and the mutiny was disbanded. Maybe we should wish we could get in the King Dude's Wayback Machine and go back and say, and trip Washington on his way there so he doesn't get there. And they take over the Continental Congress and the 13 colonies remain 13 countries. And then McDonald writes more about what happened in Twixt then and the convention. I don't agree with this anarchy, the nonsense that was going on. And I'm surprised that McDonald, that Forrest McDonald does too, because he writes, the drift towards anarchy was already underway and it increased with the rush during the winter of 1786-1787 when Shays' Rebellion erupted in Massachusetts. Again, if you read the only book worth reading about Daniel Shays and Shays' Rebellion, you will quickly come to find out that that thing was caused primarily by the, he was still a high Tory, and they named a college after Governor Bowdoin. This is primarily Bowdoin's doing. Because Bowdoin told Shays, I don't care if the Continental Army owes you $9 million, £9 million. You owe taxes in this amount, and either you pay them, or we're going to come and take your farm. And of course, these were city slickers, as it were, in Boston, meeting at Faneuil Hall, that had nothing in common with Shays, Daniel Shays, and the men that lived in the western part of Massachusetts outside of Boston. And again, it's the same story we see today. It was the virtuals living in Boston that had no idea how to farm and what it took and the rigors of it all. And then the naturalists, the farmers like Daniel Shays out there going, like, dude, you can't do that to us. We served honorably in the army, which gave you guys freedom so that you could pass these taxes. And we're asking you to stop.